Give me your attention, please, and we'll get started. What a glorious evening. I'm Dan Jordan. I'm president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, the private nonprofit corporation that's owned and operated Monticello since 1923. It's my pleasure to welcome you to our evening conversation on the subject of Thomas Jefferson, the election of 1800. I welcome you on behalf of my wife, Lou, on behalf of our colleagues on the staff, on behalf of our trustees. This is the 86th in a series that started in 1993. Peter Hatch, our scholarly director of Gardens and Grounds, was the visionary. Peter's idea was very straightforward, and that is that we should have, during the summertime, a combination of an intellectual seminar and a garden party. It was a way of calling attention to the many sides of Jefferson's interest and genius. It was a way of connecting Monticello today with the Charlottesville community. We are pleased to have two corporate sponsors this evening, our good friends at McGuire Woods and our good friends at Progress Printing. More about that later. We could not have a speaker who knows more about the subject than the individual who, in fact, wrote the book. He will be introduced by our colleague, Andrew O'Shaughnessy, who is Saunders Director of Monticello's Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies. Andrew.
The Americans run for Congress, the British stand for Parliament, and the French merely present themselves. The very language of running expresses the competitiveness and dynamism of democracy in America. Edward Larson, our speaker this evening, will talk on the subject of his recent book, A Magnificent Catastrophe, the tumultuous election of 1800, America's first presidential campaign. It is a timely publication since it reminds us that there's nothing new about negative advertising and smear campaigns. The media pundits are wrong when they talk about the decline in political rhetoric. It was better probably in 1950, but not in 1800. Professor Larson is the Hugh and Hazel Darling Professor of Law at Pepperdine University. He also has a concurrent position at Georgia University. He's the author of 6 books and 40 academic articles. He won the Pulitzer Prize in History for his book Summer of the Gods, The Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Professor Larson will now remind us of the truth of the old adage that good food does not always come from clean kitchens. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. This is indeed a tremendous honor to be here. This is one of the shrines of America. Dan, you have done a remarkable job. You've took a jewel and you polished it to the finest glimmer. And I thank you so much for having me here. And Andrew, I'm fascinated by the work you're working on right now and all you've brought to scholarship here. So it's truly an honor. I can't think of any place I'd rather be standing anywhere and talking on this subject. Now, I'll warn you that Andrew asked me in several backs and forth to he kept wanting me to focus down this talk from the election to the negative campaigning to finally on religion and the role of religion and science in the election of 1800. So with that, I thought it was appropriate focus topic, and we'll launch it. In 1800, the United States remained a fundamentally Christian nation, even if the nature of that religious establishment was evolving. Before the Revolution, colonies typically provided governmental support for one favored denomination, usually the Church of England or, in New England, the Congregational Church, and required office holders to profess their faith in Jesus Christ as Lord. During the Revolution, from 1776 to 1783, the Church of England in America renounced the king's leadership and became the Episcopal Church, but still lost its preferred status in most states, with Governor Thomas Jefferson leading the charge here in Virginia. Dissenting sects, particularly the Baptist and the Methodist, flourished among the people as revivalism spread. Now remember the setting. Remember England. And all the European monarchs at the time had state churches that propped up the crown and actively repressed dissenters. Some patriots saw our revolution as against monarchism in all of its forms and all of its trappings, including the established church. Jefferson was one of these. Although there were Enlightenment deists, Unitarians, and secularists in the uppermost echelons of both parties, the issue of religion had become an increasingly partisan one during the 1790s, that is, a decade after the Revolution, in the wake of the French Revolution, in which the radical Jacobin faction had moved so abruptly and violently to break the back of church authority and the hold of religious dogma on the people. Widespread support in America for the revolution in France by partisans of Jefferson's opposition faction, which, as you know, became known as the Democrats. Indeed, at the time, that's what their opponents called them. And for simplicity in this paper, I'll simply call them the Democrats. Partisans of these Democrats were portrayed by many in the ruling Federalist Party as the support of the French Revolution was portrayed as support for the secularism of that revolution, including its opposition to Christianity. These Federalists, many of whom, as I've noted, were not active Christians themselves, some of them deists, some of them Unitarians, these Federalists pointed to what Jefferson had done in Virginia, that is, disestablish the Anglican Church, and drew extravagant parallels between it and developments in France. Indeed, this became one of the prongs of the negative campaigning used against Thomas Jefferson. By the 1800 presidential election, which pitted incumbent President John Adams against the sitting Vice President Thomas Jefferson, Federalists could point to the terrors of Jacobin France as the logical consequence of trying to rule without religion. 2 years before the election, Timothy Dwight, America's leading evangelical minister and a virtual institution in his home state of Connecticut, laid down the gauntlet against Jeffersonian secularism in a published 4th of July patriotic oration. Dwight knew that Jefferson would be running for president 2 years later. He had actively led the opposition to Jefferson 2 years earlier in the quasi-campaign and now was getting ready for the next election. In this oration, which was widely reprinted around the country and became the key sort of manifesto against Jefferson, that bits and pieces were taken continually throughout the election, what he does is Dwight interprets an end-time biblical prophecy from John's Revelation. And taking it, Dwight posits that Americans were living under the outpouring of the sixth vial of God's wrath when the Antichrist empire crumbled and humankind embarked on what Dwight called, quote, a professed and unusual opposition to God, quoting, of course, from the Bible, that leads directly to Armageddon. Dwight saw the crumbling of the Antichrist empire and the collapse of Roman Catholicism before the revolutionary armies of France, and marked opposition to God and the rise of Enlightenment naturalism throughout Europe. In Dwight's mind, Jefferson and his partisans, as proponents of French secularism in America, served as the unwitting link between this vast satanic conspiracy and the United States. And I'm only dampening the enthusiasm with which he described it. As he wrote, Secular chaos had replaced Christian order in France, and it could happen in the United States too if anti-clerical leaders like Jefferson took power. Dwight asked, and these are just some phrases that were repeated throughout the campaign. One place Dwight asked, "For what end shall we be connected with men," he's speaking about Jefferson, "with men of whom this is the character and conduct? Is it to see our churches become temples of reason?" Remember, that happened at Notre Dame. "Is that we may see the Bible cast into the bonfire?" Remember, that happened in France as well. "Is it that we may see our wives and daughters the victim of legalized prostitution?" All these acts had become commonplace in France, he claimed. Again quoting, "Shall our sons become the disciples of Voltaire, or our daughters the concubine of the Illuminati?" Only Christian leaders can foster ordered liberty, Dwight maintained. Quote, "If our religion were gone, our state of our society would perish with it, and nothing would be left which would be worth defending." Now, Dwight's words carried weight. Dubbed the Pope of Connecticut by his opponents, Dwight served as president of Yale College for over 2 decades. From that post, he shepherded both his state's Federalist Party and its established church. His brother represented Connecticut in Congress. Grandson of the legendary evangelical theologian Jonathan Edwards, Dwight was an ordained minister in the state-supported Congregational Church. In books, sermons, lectures, and even poems, he used his keen intellect and sharp wit to promote his views of politics and religion. He campaigned continuously against Jefferson throughout the election cycle, giving speeches, writing books, traveling widely, and enlisted others on what was already emerging as the religious right to join his campaign. During the anxious months leading up to the presidential election, countless tracts, essays, and sermons damned Jefferson as a deist or worse, and called on Christians to oppose his candidacy. The flurry of activity bore the hallmarks of a coordinated campaign, but it may have simply emanated from the collective angst of countless Christians, especially from the established churches of the Northeast, confronted with the prospect of something new, a president who did not defer to their beliefs. In their official capacities while president, Washington and Adams had publicly acknowledged God's sovereignty, and Christianity had flourished. Its prospects under Jeffersonian rule look less certain. Even though critics regularly accused him of holding such views, Jefferson never publicly professed either deism or atheism. When asked about the subject at this time, Jefferson later recalled, "My answer always was to say nothing of my religion. It is known to my God and myself alone," end quote. By 1800, he was probably a Unitarian in his views, not a deist and certainly not an atheist. To make their case against Jefferson, since he did not say it himself, Federalists turned to circumstantial evidence. As the election approached, Federalist orators and pamphleteers endlessly repeated the same few hints of heresy drawn from Jefferson's words and actions. Notes on the State of Virginia, written by Jefferson nearly 2 decades earlier, provided most of the fodder for his opponents. In it, for example, Jefferson defended his position on the separation of church and state by observing, and I quote, "The legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." End quote. No one would make such claims who believed in God or appreciated religion's role in maintaining ordered liberty, Federalist charge. One pamphleteer warned, and I'm quoting, about 2 months before the election, "Ponder well this paragraph. 10,000 impieties and mischiefs lurk in its womb," another added, "Let my neighbor once perceive himself that there is no God, and he will soon pick my pocket and break not only my leg, but my neck." Three other passages from Notes on Virginia caught the eyes of election-era religious inquisitors. First, Jefferson denied the flood of Noah's time. Described in the Bible as covering all the earth, Jefferson denied that it could not possibly have submerged Virginia's mountains. Second, he suggested in Notes of Virginia also that various human races had separate origins, which allegedly contradicted, according to these tracts, the biblical account of Adam and Eve as the first parents of all people. Third, he proposed that school children learn history rather than study the Bible, quote, at an age where their judgments are not sufficiently matured for religious inquiries. Federalist asserted that such a critical approach towards the study of Scripture disqualified Jefferson for the presidency. In their public attacks, Christian critics drew on evidence from Jefferson's public and private life to complete their picture of him as an infidel. Jefferson rarely attended church services, they noted. He desecrated the Sabbath by working and even holding parties on Sunday. He did not invoke biblical authority or acknowledge Christ in the Declaration of Independence. A campaign tract addressed to Delaware voters by a self-proclaimed, quote, Christian Federalist, put the issue in blunt terms. Quote, "If Jefferson is elected and the Jacobins get into authority," it declared, "those morals which protect our lives from the knife of the assassin, which guard the chastity of our wives and daughters from seduction and violence, defend our property from plunder and devaluation, and shield our religion from contempt and damnation, will be trampled upon and exploded." Probably capturing the best of any, in a bold-faced notice captioned, "The Grand Question Stated," all capital letters, banner headline, and reprinted every day during the months of September and October leading up to the election, the Gazette of the United States of America, which was the nation's flagship Federalist newspaper, the leading paper that the Federalist had, carried and reprinted throughout the country. It was as much a house organ of the Adams administration as Fox News is of the Republican Party today. It starkly, under this banner, "The Grand Question Stated," it starkly presented the choice facing Christian voters in austere times. It's a block with a big black line around it on the front page of every single paper every day. And what it said below that, "The Grand Question," not one of the questions, "The Grand Question," it stated, "at the present solemn, momentous epoch, the only question to be asked by every American laying his hand on his heart is, shall I continue in allegiance with God and a religious president, or impiously declare for Jefferson and no God? ! Stated this way, the choice seemed easy. Although Jefferson privately denounced, quote, the lying pamphlets and absolute falsehoods of his Christian critics, he feared that responding to them public would make matters worse. Quote, "As to the charges of atheism, I am so broken to charges of every kind that I entirely disregard it," Jefferson wrote to James Monroe in May of 1800. Quote, "It has been so impossible to contradict all of their lies that I have determined to contradict none. For while I should be engaged with one, they would publish 20 new ones." While Jefferson thus publicly remained above the fray and didn't directly answer the religious charges, that's not what his supporters did, orchestrated and organized right from here in Monticello and also from up the road at Madison's home and down the road at Monroe's home. I guess Monroe was then in Richmond. They organized a coordinated attack, and his partisans rushed to his defense. In separate pamphlets, longtime Democratic propagandist John Beckley characterized Jefferson as, quote, an adorer of our God. And New York Democratic politician and future governor DeWitt Clinton, who, of course, was the son of the Jefferson's future vice president, George Clinton, hailed Jefferson, quote, as a real Christian. In their hands, Notes of Virginia became an epistle of orthodoxy, and they made selective quotes of their own. Democrats everywhere throughout the country, in a coordinated fashion, wooed Baptist, Methodist, Catholics, and local members of smaller denominations, the Quakers, the Jews, by contrasting Jefferson's support for religious liberty in Virginia with Adams' deference to an established church in Massachusetts. Indeed, Democrats most deftly played the religion card when they linked Federalist support for civil religion with their larger campaign to paint Federalists as anti-democratic crypto-monarchists. The arch-democratic Hartford Mercury, newspaper in Hartford, Connecticut, for example, published a satirical creed for Federalists, which played on their supporters, played on the Federalist support for an established church. And in this creed, they named the three most visible Federalist leaders of the day, other than Adams himself. And I'll give you a tone. This goes a little longer than this. You can sort of know exactly how long it goes. Those who go to Episcopal churches, you can get in the rhythm. It fits the exact lines, but I'll just read it, quotes to give you enough. This is the Hartford Mercury. This is reprinted in Democrat newspapers throughout the country. I believe in Alexander Hamilton, the mighty Creole, mighty and puissant general of the standing army, it affirmed, and in vice presidential candidate Charles Coatsworthy Pinckney, his friend and faithful follower, who was sent from heaven above to save this hapless country from the calamities of a Republican government and to confer upon it the beauty, splendor, and glory of a monarchy. Completing the Federalist Trinity, the creed turned on Adams' high-handed Secretary of State. And I believe in the virtuous efforts of Timothy Pinckney to prevent a peace with France and to unite us again with the English nation. This creed neatly encapsulated many of the popular arguments against continuing Federalist rule. It presumably did not include Adams in its partisan trinity, because doing so would violate the Sedition Act, which would mean its editors would go to jail. And this act barred malicious criticism of the president, but did not protect Hamilton or the vice presidential candidate. Turning the tables on their accusers, Democrats also questioned the piety or religious orthodoxy of many leading Federalists. This was a very clever approach to take. Remember, their candidate is being attacked as a deist or worse. Now, the Democrats are responding. For example, they charged, despite his bow to civil religion by participating in public worship and proclaiming national days of prayer and fasting, Adams, they claimed, which was true, differed little from Jefferson in his personal beliefs about God. Both men inclined toward Unitarianism, though Adams kept it under wraps better than Jefferson, and regularly, at least while president, attended conventional Christian church services. This led some partisans to accuse Adams of hypocrisy. Clinton, remember, DeWitt Clinton, the future governor, Riley noted in his pamphlet, I have always understood that Mr. Jefferson belonged to the Episcopal Church. How often he attends, I have not inquired, but I believe he does so with as much sincerity as Mr. Adams. With both candidates sullied, some partisans descended to the level of debating the relative merits of a pious hypocrite versus a known infidel as president. In a long newspaper essay, for example, a Democrat wrote, Now, I don't know that John Adams is a hypocrite or that Jefferson is a deist. Yet, supposing they are, I am of the opinion the last ought to be preferred to the first, because a secret enemy is worse than an open and avowed one. Writing for the Carolina Gazette, an exasperated Federalist replied, Mr. Adams may have no more real religion than my horse, but in a contest with an open infidel, all serious men would prefer the one who at least acknowledges his respect for his maker. For the most part, however, Christians on both sides probably accepted the professions of faith made on behalf of their party's candidates and voting accordingly. Federalists proudly pointed to Adams' public support for religious institutions. The president attended church, invoked God's name in his speeches, and declared days of prayer and fasting. Democrats countered by noting Jefferson's passion for religious liberty. He authored the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. Both political parties, in short, took Christian voters very seriously in this election. And it helped to turn the tide from Jefferson's two electoral vote loss in Adams in 1796, when Jefferson supporters never bothered to respond to Adams' attacks, the Federalist tax on religion, and never sought to court religious voters and take them seriously, to his one-state margin of victory over Adams in 1800. Watching this happen, and he saw it. Adams was a very astute politician who followed what was happening to him very closely and never forgot a slight. Watching this happen to him during the course of the campaign, but absolutely powerless to stop him because the Federalist attack machine was in full mode and he couldn't do anything to stop it. Late in the campaign, Adams privately complained that by its overzealous attacks, which often invoked religion in a matter which smacked of imposing a Christian religious test for public office, the Federalist, and I'm quoting right here, the Federalist press had done more to shuffle the cards into the hands of the Jacobin leaders, the Federalist always called Jefferson a Jacobin, in the hands of the Jacobin leaders than all the acts of the administration and all the policies of the opposition. In later years, Adams came to see his party's visible association with members of politically active church groups, particularly evangelicals who lobbied for national days of prayer and public displays of religion, as an undeserved blackball against him in 1800. Quoting from Adams, "The secret whisper ran through all the sects." By sects he means the Baptists, the Catholics, everybody but him. "The secret whisper ran through all the sects. Let us have Jefferson, Madison, Burr, anybody, whether they be philosophers, deists, or even atheists, rather than a Presbyterian president." Referring to the Presbyterians at the time, this was a denomination that he never joined, but that boasted many Federalist members, and had come to represent, for many Americans, establishment evangelicalism in the public mind. Adams saw it as a smear campaign fought over religion in high places that left Americans with a devil of a choice for president. As adept as their opponents in exaggerating the negative traits associated with the other side, Federalists portrayed Democrats as violent economic levelers, devoid of any principle except those that serve their immediate self-interest. Quote, "They are composed of French intriguers, English fugitives from justice, and many of the worst sorts of Americans," one typical campaign address said of the Democrats. The Gazette of the United States depicted Democratic leaders as, quote, "chimney sweeper politicians and scavenger statesmen," and characterized their followers as, quote, "the very refuge and filth of society." A learned Virginia gentleman, Jefferson obviously did not fit these characterizations. Federalists instead have portrayed him as a dreamy idealist, corrupted by atheistical French philosophy and utterly incapable of providing practical political leadership. Whatever his personal and intellectual virtues, should Jefferson gain office, Federalists feared that he could never control the godless partisan rabble that would take power with him. Intellectual elitists themselves, Federalists appealed to anti-intellectualism in smearing Jefferson. His pursuit of natural science and interest in philosophy all but disqualified him for high office, they claimed. Quote, "Science and government are different paths. He that walks in one, at every step, becomes less qualified to walk with steadfastness or virtue in the other. A Federalist pamphleteer charged against Jefferson, "Oh, that his friends were aware that to him the honorable station is a private one, that mankind would suffer his talents and energies to be harmlessly exhausted in adjusting the bones of nondescript animals, or tracing the pedigree of savage tribes who no longer exist." Jefferson had published research along these lines in Notes on Virginia, which had earned him an international reputation in science. And this, his opponents thought, he should just return to this house and study, as they put it, nondescript animals and savage tribes that no longer exist. Jefferson had also studied philosophy, which Federalists portrayed as even more problematic than his work in science. Quote, "He is so true a philosopher as to all matters of fact," the Federalists, the New England Palladium, reported. "Philosophers admire no government that is practical. They trust no theory, except those that are untried. Even the most elite Federalist worried about too much philosophy in government." Treasury Secretary Oliver Wolcott wrote in August of 1800, "Mr. Jefferson's conduct would be frequently whimsical and undignified. He would affect the character of a philosopher and countenance quacks." The aristocratic Charles Carroll of Carrollton, who lived like a feudal lord on his Maryland manor, suggested that Jefferson should try his experiments in government on the Lilliputian European Republic of San Marino, rather than on the United States. Quote, "His fantastic tricks would dissolve the Union," Carroll warned. Against the dangerous principle of Jefferson's philosophy, a North Carolina pamphleteer added in July, "I have only to direct your view to that ill-fated country in France and bring to your recollection the history of the horrid government of their philosophers who profess similar principles to Jefferson." Well, I could go on and on and on both sides. After three largely nonpartisan presidential campaigns in which the candidates themselves had not campaigned for office, the 1800 election tore open a deep and polarizing fissure in the national politics that has remained a feature of it ever since. Two parties would contend for power by portraying the other as extreme while attempting to center itself in the middle. Because of the deeply held religious beliefs of so many American voters, religion inevitably became a shuttlecock in this partisan posturing. Neither side could afford to lose a significant majority of the votes of Christians and still win the presidency. Both sides would play on popular religious passions and concerns. The characteristic form of American politics took shape in the election of 1800, with religion as part of the give and take. Thank you. We have plenty of time for questions.
Congratulations. Thank you. We thank Ed for his erudite and eloquent remarks, and now we get to the part of the evening that is a conversation. So we would like to ask anyone who has a question to please stand. And Ed, in some cases, you might repeat the question if you think that the audience at large has missed it. But he's very happy to take any questions you might have. He has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin and a law degree from Harvard. So please fire away when ready. And I'll let you take it from here.
Whichever way. The question was, it was one state that decided the election, and can you decide that state? That's a wonderful question. And it's wonderful because it has such a rich possible answer. Indeed, I spent a whole book talking about it. Everyone knew the election would be very, very close. They didn't have polls back then, but these guys, whether you're talking about Hamilton or Jefferson or Madison or Monroe or Aaron Burr or Adams, had an incredibly sensitive feel and touch they knew the politics as well as any poll could tell them. They knew each state. And what I do in my book is I break down, I think for the first time, the election into a series of state campaigns, because what makes it so interesting is they didn't elect vote all at one time. The states could hold their elections whenever they wanted to choose their electors. And it's just they just had to have it by the first Wednesday in December when the electors had to meet. And the states could change the rules any way they wanted to. And when the first elections were held, most states used district elections. Because, Governor Morris devised this Rube Goldberg device of the Electoral College. And threw it in. It wasn't Madison's fault. It was in the Constitution, but Madison had nothing to do with the Electoral College. Only Governor Morris's puckish mind could have come up with such a contraption. And so it looked like we're going to have district elections because you divide it up based on congressional districts, really. And so that's how initially most states thought they'd have it. They'd have elections in each congressional district because the idea of Governor Morris is said, we don't want to elect the president. We want to elect wise people who then choose the president. And you can only elect wise people if you know them. And that's why congressional districts were so small. The voters, which was a small electorate back then, male property owners, adult, could know their candidates. And so electors would win in these districts. But some states didn't do it that way. Some states decided, well, we'll let the state legislature pick the electors. Well, and what happened was the first two elections, Washington, they knew Washington was going to win, and the question was who would be vice president, and Adams competed against George Clinton in one and Aaron Burr in the other for vice president. And then they got to the third one, and they didn't have a clear picture, but still they didn't campaign. And that's how Jefferson ended up coming in number two, because each cast one vote, and Jefferson, the opposition, became vice president. And they all use these different schemes, and they voted at different times, starting a full calendar year before the election. And states would vote at different times. And it would be like our primaries. And it took, 2 weeks to get the news across the country. And everybody in the country, this is all the country cared about, this election. It totally transfixed. They thought America was going to hell in a handbasket. The quasi-war with France, the soaring taxes, the Shays Rebellion, the Fries Rebellion, excuse me. All these things were happening. The partisan newspapers had been formed during the preceding 4 years, which were presenting the news from their own viewpoint. And the country was transfixed on this. It's all that mattered, who would win. And so in states where the legislature chose the electors, the campaigns for state Senate and state House of Representative turned solely on who you would vote for. Would you vote for an elector committed to Jefferson or an elector committed to Adams? They weren't trying to elect wise people. They were elected now committed electors who had vowed to vote one way or the other. So, and then in states which had district elections, that would be the campaigns would run on who would be the candidate. With the electors support Jefferson or Adams. And so that was the whole focus of all these campaigns for a year. And you would be sitting around the country, and every newspaper would run box scores, just like we run for counting up delegates. And they'd fill in each state when the state had its election. And then the news would get around, and so you'd see the vote totals building. Adams would go ahead, then Jefferson would go ahead, and they'd project who they think was going to win for the others. And if it was a Federalist newspapers, inevitably the Federalists were going to win. If it was a Republican, Democratic newspaper, inevitably Jefferson was going to win. And it'd go back and forth. So the question is, what state turned it? The vote total was so close between Jefferson and Adams that any state would have turned it. It was like the last elections we've had. If any state had gone the other way, Adams would have won. So every state was decisive, and they knew it, and they battled in each state. Now, there are some states they knew they couldn't win. Jefferson knew he couldn't win in Massachusetts, but he could still win some electoral votes in the districts, right? Adams knew he couldn't win in Virginia, but he could win some of the electoral votes in some of the districts. He had won some in 1796. He'd won a few electoral votes in Virginia. So what they did was, as the election got close, they pushed Monroe as the governor and got Monroe governor here with the sole plan to change the way Virginia voted in the middle of the vote from having district elections where Adams would win a couple to having one statewide election where you'd win all, if you won statewide, you'd get all the electors, the winner-take-all approach that we now know. This was Madison and Monroe's brainstorm. We're going to not, we lost by two votes. If we seal down Virginia, we'll win. And so they pushed through the legislature in the middle of the campaign a switch to statewide voting in this state, which we never had, not even the governor. Nobody ran statewide in Virginia because the ideal, even Jefferson would say, you've got to know your candidates. You've got to elected locally. So Virginia moved to statewide voting. Well, as soon as they did, Massachusetts retaliated, and they moved to statewide voting, and New Hampshire did too. And suddenly there was an arms race of states in the middle of the campaign moving to statewide voting. And so you have to play with what state did it. Virginia's switch to statewide voting. Jefferson wouldn't have won without it. New York. Aaron Burr pulled off a miracle in New York. Probably by stuffing the ballot box in the 7th Ward of New York City. And as in reward, he insisted on the vice presidency. Without New York, I mean, that was the big tide turner. That voted fairly early. And that was a key Adams state in the previous election. And when New York flipped in April, Adams despaired. And he said, what can I do to win? He fired his cabinet. He pardoned Fraser. He abolished the standing army. He moved to the middle. He abandoned all the conservative approaches. He says, I've lost New York. To win, he shifted the middle and made the first campaign whistle stop tour. It wouldn't be whistle stop. He was in a carriage. Ever in American history. He went campaigning around in states that were in doubt. Actually campaigning, speaking. First time a president had ever gone out campaigning. Jefferson said, should I do that? And Monroe and Madison said, no, you're so terrible as a speaker. You better stay right there in Monticello. And write a lot of letters, which he did. And they sent his speakers around. So in a way, New York was decisive. And most historians would say it was New York was decisive. But in the end, you say what was decisive. The other states that would have a claim, Virginia would have a claim for moving to statewide voting. Massachusetts would have a claim. You didn't know you were going to get this long an answer. New York would have a claim, but in the end, it was Pennsylvania and South Carolina, which where the legislature chose the electors. And the problem was, Pennsylvania was split, with one party controlling the Senate and one other party controlled the House. South Carolina still voted was. Nobody knew who controlled it because families controlled the legislature there, and it was not yet a partisan state. And so the outcome of those two states were going to decide it, and nobody knew how they'd vote. And they delayed and they delayed and they delayed because neither side wanted to pull the plug because they thought they were going to lose. And so both of them voted only hours before they had to meet. The electors had to meet at noon on the first Wednesday of December. And they both waited because they wanted to hear what the other state had done. But finally, when they couldn't hear, they ended up going ahead and voting. And the trick was South Carolina, because Coatsworthy Pinckney was trying to do, what the high guard Federalists were trying to do, was to get South Carolina to cast their electoral votes. Each one cast one electoral vote for Jefferson and one for Pinckney. That would have made Pinckney president, because the High Federalists didn't like Adams. They wanted to get Pinckney, who was the puppet of Hamilton, as the presidency. And that's why they ran him as the alleged vice president. And so they were playing a funny game in South Carolina. And in the end, Charles Pinckney, the cousin of Charles Coatsworthy Pinckney, both had signed the Declaration of Independence. No, both had been at the Constitutional Convention. But they hated each other. As family politics in South Carolina still is. And Charles Pinckney was a Jefferson supporter, and Charles Coatsworthy Pinckney was the vice presidential candidate for the Federalist. And Charles Pinckney won, pulled it out by a couple votes. And so Jefferson got all the votes from South Carolina, and they split Pennsylvania 50-50. And that was enough to put Jefferson ahead. But the news took a while to pass. 2 weeks after the election, Adams still thought he'd won. That's how close the election was. So it literally went up to the last minute, and nobody knew who was going to win. And Jefferson thought he'd lost because they thought South Carolina was going to split. And they thought, Jefferson thought and Madison thought Pinckney would be president and Jefferson would be vice president again. Adams thought somehow it would come out his way. And so that's how close it was. And so what state? Now you got a whole summary of the election. Sorry for talking. I'll be shorter, I promise. Oh, but that's a different story. Of course, the problem was Adams was only a Adam. The question was, she thought it was a tie between Burr and Jefferson. Well, it was, but that's a different question. The question was, why was it a one-state election? The Federalist fell only a four votes short. That's why any state could have flipped it. Well, not Kentucky, but almost any state could have flipped it to Adams. But what was happening is, to the very end, because they didn't know how South Carolina and Pennsylvania were voting, and a lot of scenarios had Jefferson winning by just one vote. Depending on how these states broke down, a lot of them had Jefferson winning by one vote. A lot of the scenarios, because they knew they were down to two states. And you can break down how the vote's going to come down. And a lot of the states having Jefferson tying Pinckney. Tying Pinckney. Well, the theory with when you're running a vice presidential candidate, the problem is your electors cast two equal votes. You don't cast one for president and one for vice president back. Then you just cast two votes. And the way a party picks the president is they get one of their electors to not vote for one of their candidates. So for example, one of Adams's electors didn't vote for Pinckney. He voted for John Jay. And that left Adams one vote ahead of Pinckney. Because the question is, each elector gets two votes. They have to vote for two people. Whoever comes in first becomes president. Whoever comes second comes vice president. As I said, I warned you, only Gouverneur Morris could have invented such a Rube Goldberg device. But he had ulterior motives, and I could get into it if you want. So the problem was that Republicans, the Jefferson's party, couldn't give away a vote. Because they didn't know if they gave away a vote, Jefferson might have come in first or tied with Pinckney, but Aaron Burr, his vice presidential candidate, would come in third. And that would make either Adams his vice president or Pinckney his vice president. And they knew what messed up Adams more than anything when he was president is while he was sitting as president, Adam Jefferson, his sworn enemy, was vice president, taking pot shots all the time from presiding over the Senate as president of the Senate. Jefferson had a podium to being attacking Adams for 4 years. And the last thing they wanted was to get Adams or Pinckney as the vice president. So they all had to vote together to make sure that Jefferson came in, and Burr both came in ahead of any of the Federalists. Well, the problem was, Aaron Burr was Aaron Burr. He was a self-interested, pragmatic politician. And once he comes in a tie, the Federalist... Now the presidency is going to be chosen by the House of Representatives voting by states. And the Federalist, it's the lame duck, it's the old House of Representatives, the one that's going out. And neither party controlled the majority of the states. And the Federalists decided to back Burr. And they were going to vote for Burr, and they thought they'd buy off some of the Democrats, because all they needed was a couple more votes, individual congressional votes. And Burr would be president, and they thought nothing would mess up the opposition more than putting Burr, the number two person, in front of Jefferson, and making Jefferson the vice president again would just tear the opposition party apart. And so that's why you had a whole second election occurring in the House of Representatives, but it wasn't the presidential, it was for a president, but it wasn't the one state margin. It was this Donnybrook in the House of Representatives, and they immediately after, and it took 35 ballots. And finally, when it became, then finally what happened, what ended it, was the Federalist would not budge, and they had a veto control in the House. and they were going to stay with, they were just voting Burr, 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 Burr. Jefferson, the Democrats were voting Jefferson, 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 but neither had a majority of the states. There were two states that had absolutely split delegations, half of one party, half of the other. They couldn't vote because they were split, and they couldn't choose a president. And they've cast 35 ballots. And if the time ran out of the term, of current sitting term of the president, nobody knew what would happen. And what the Federalists claim would be the president pro tem of the Senate would become president under the Constitution, or the Congress could pass legislation naming a president, and they would name the Secretary of State, John Marshall, or the president pro tem of the Senate, who was a Federalist, and then they'd cling to power. And that's what they were writing in the newspapers they were going to do. And so Matt Monroe called up the militia, as did the governor of Pennsylvania, Tom McCain, who were both elected on a Jeffersonian platform. And they said, and they got all the Democratic governors in to agree that if no president were picked by the inauguration day, that the Constitution would be null and void. And we'd go back under the Articles of Confederation. And our states would dissolve the Union. We would go back under the Articles of Confederation. And Matt Monroe and McCain raised their militia and said, and if you try to put somebody else in power, we're going to march on Washington, D.C. And both troops were ready to march. And the Federalists, remember, their whole purpose in life was the Constitution. That's why they were called the Federalists. And that bluff was real. We don't know. And Monroe was as tough a politician as you could imagine. And so was Tom McKean. Tom McKean, of course, had signed both the Declaration of Independence and was at the Constitution Convention. You tell what a good politician Tom McKean was. He was at one time, his house was right on the border between, literally on the border between Delaware and Pennsylvania. It was in both states. You can still visit it. And he at one time was both the congressman from Delaware and the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court at the same time. They both met in Philadelphia. And then, of course, he was governor of Pennsylvania at this time. And they said, you know, we're going to destroy the Union if you don't let Jefferson be president. And so that's when the Federalists finally backed down. And what they did is they just didn't vote. None of them voted for Jefferson. But they didn't vote, and that gave Jefferson enough states to win. But that was a battle. That was a whole different. That was a different part of the campaign. But it makes it a fun election. Yes.
How does satire play out in the election of 1800 up to the New Yorker today?
Well, the New Yorker today would have been. You know, the problem with the New Yorker is I have no idea what they're trying to do. If that had been published in the New York Post, right, that's the Republican newspaper, it would have been typical of the type of cartoons that were in the 1800 election. There are lots of cartoons like that. They're cartoons showing Jefferson literally dancing with the devil. Those were the cartoons that were in Federalist newspapers. Literally. They have ones of John Adams with the crown and passing it on to John Quincy as the heir. It would have been typical. Now, what throws me on this one is, what's the New Yorker? What are they doing? And I don't know. But in that sort, if you call it satire, but usually that would be the sort of thing very similar as you'd see in this previous election, in the 1800 election. But it would always be coming from the other side in their periodicals, but it would just be typical of the type of things back then. Another question. Yes, sir.
Jefferson's thoughts on having troops march on Washington.
He actually delivered the news to Adams. He personally went down and told Adams this is what's going to happen. He said, "We don't want to do this, but we will." So he personally delivered the news. It was Monroe's idea, best we can tell from the letters, but he personally delivered the news. Oh, one last question. Yes.
Had there been libel laws in those days, what do you think would have happened except everybody suing everybody?
Well, there were libel laws in some states, and people were suing. Tom McKean, the person I mentioned, was always trying to throw his opponents in jail all the time. And it both when he was Chief Justice, it was especially easy for him to do. But the Federalists had the Sedition Acts. In the run-up to the election, the Federalist Congress passed the Sedition Acts that made it a crime to make malicious statements, false and malicious statements against the President of the United States or the government. And during the campaign, and Jefferson had opposed them, that Virginia passed a resolution declaring them unconstitutional, as did Kentucky. And when Virginia passed the resolution declaring them unconstitutional, Hamilton proposed Hamilton was a general of the standing army. He proposed taking the army and invading Richmond and abolishing the legislature. And he was going to do it. And Wolcott, the war minister, was all for it. And Adams, when he heard about it, pulled out his hair. He said, and this is a quote, he said, when he heard that Hamilton was going to take the army and invade Richmond, he said, this is a direct quote, we wrote it down, either that man is mad or I am. And then he abolished the army. That prompted him to abolish the army because he was afraid Hamilton would be using it in that way. That's when he was moving moderate. That was after they'd lost New York and they were getting desperate. He heard about it after. That's when he abolished it. But what they did, they used the Sedition Act, and they went around the country, Justice Chase literally went around the country, closing down Democratic newspapers, one after another, came right to Richmond, had a trial in Richmond, shut down the paper there, put Callender in jail, went all around, and the sentence term was always to one day after the election. And they would put the editors in jail and try to shut down the newspapers, and so that's how they responded. So that's a little bit like it's called the Sedition Act, but it's a little bit like libel laws. And the grounds of them were hilarious, because they could say anything you couldn't prove is true would be grounds. And so they put one poor person in jail for saying that Adams had a large ass. And he ended up in jail for saying that because he couldn't prove. He said he'd never actually seen Adams, so he didn't know he had a large ass. And that testimony alone. There were that use, but of course the Democrats, Jefferson's party, had no recourse to federal courts because all the judges had been appointed by Federalists, and their only recourse were to state courts where they controlled the state government, and those were Virginia and some of the Pennsylvania and some of the southern states, and they would try to use the state courts. So it was a they used every tactic and every advantage. But let me say in closing that I think both sides did it, even though they knew, Adams deplored the sort of stuff that the Federalists were saying. He said, I know this is not true, and he was embarrassed by it. But they did it because they truly believed in their vision for the country. And they really thought, they honestly believed, I've come to the convinced, they honestly believed that if the other side would take power, the country would be destroyed. The Democrats truly believed that one more term of the Federalists, with the Sedition Acts, with the quasi-war with France, with the soaring national debt, with the soaring taxes, with the Alien Acts, they honestly believed that the country wouldn't survive as a democratic republic. And in contrast, the Federalists truly believed that if the Democrats took power, the country would collapse. And so they knew what they were doing far exceeded the truth, but they thought they needed to do that to communicate it to the people. And so I believe they went to negative campaigning for good motives. Hamilton and Adams and Jefferson, maybe not Burr, Madison, Monroe, Burr, I think, just wanted power. But the others, they truly were trying to protect and promote and defend their vision of what America could be and should be. It's just they just had different visions. What?
I think in the end, grudgingly, they came around. And it took longer for Adams and Jefferson to come around than Hamilton and Madison and Monroe, who were more Pinckney, who were more instinctively that way. But I think ultimately they came around because they thought so much was at stake. And Jefferson's letters to his daughters, who he dearly loved during the campaign, reflected the pain he felt to going through this crucible, but how he kept saying, I'm doing it for you. I'm doing it for those you love, to preserve this country for you, my daughters, and for the future. And I do believe that was his, down deep, that was his driving force. Well,